this week on The Inside Flap.
But even I was taken aback. There were parts of drafting this book, like the first half of it, when things are really ramping up. I think I know which parts you're thinking of. My husband was on a business trip before the pandemic. And so I slept with the lights on because I was scaring myself silly.
Oh,
you know?
Man.
I'm a massive wuss. And this is like me exposing myself as a horror writer.
Women dress up in their...
Were the women dressed up for this, Dave?
The women get dressed up.
You only sent me photos of men.
Well, listen... You think for 1 second I'm going around
that's a good
snapping
point.
Pictures
that's
in
a really good
private
point.
And secrecy
no.
of women?
Okay,
no,
okay.
That is correct.
That's a really good
no, good God, no. I didn't want to get arrested.
Sorry.
I did take lots of pictures of
men. I saw pictures of men, though. The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Broadcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us out there for episode 169. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And on the couch to my left is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Thank you guys once again for being with us today.
The Inside Flap.
Got a great guest for you today. We're joined by Isabel Cañas. She is a Mexican-American speculative fiction writer who lives, as we just found out today, as we literally just talked to her this morning, lives in our old neck of the woods in Brooklyn, in Park Slope, and just got her doctorate in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. Her debut novel is out now. It's called The Hacienda. And here's something fun that happened. So after we chatted with her today, and I had some time to kill, and I had that tattered cover gift card I still hadn't used.
Oh, yeah.
So I marched across...
Did you buy a medieval studies book?
I marched, no. Marched across the street from East High School, where I'm teaching, and I walked in the door... And what do I see right to the left? Yes, is the book you're holding in your hot little hands right now, just out today, The Hacienda. And I said to the guy behind the counter, I said, I just
did you really say it?
I mean, how could I not?
Yeah, but then did he believe you?
I said, just talked to that author this morning. And he's like,
good for you, buddy.
Okay, great. Bob, how do we work these gift cards again? I said, okay. And then I brought it up with Bob, and Bob was a little more interested. He came out from behind the counter.
Oh, really? Bob was interested?
And I'm trying to get into thrillers. What would you recommend over here? And I got and he pointed to the Laura Lippman. He's like, how's Laura Lippman? I said, oh, well, we've spoken with Laura Lippman. Yeah, she was here. She's funny. I said,
she is
funny.
She's smart. Mm-hmm. They're all smart.
They're all funny. Yeah. They're not all funny.
Isabel
was delightful to talk to.
She's charming.
And we will have that conversation for you in just a little bit, as well as our book recommendations.
Book reviews.
And
audiobook of the week.
The audiobook of the week. And I got an oldie this week, but a goodie.
Oh.
An oldie, but a goodie.
All
There's
right.
your little teaser for that. But first, just got back from a weekend trip to Maryland, good old Maryland, where our
friend... Alan Andrew's trading places with you.
That's right, and he's heading out to Maryland in a couple of days here, but our good friend Dave Thomas invited me out invited Andrew out as well, but with another trip coming up this week, a little too many trips to Maryland for Andrew to take. But we went to do a little horse track wagering.
Shocker.
Now, as you know, it is, Dave Thomas, he does enjoy himself some gambling. So any trip involving a visit to Dave Thomas is going to involve some kind of gambling.
And Dave Thomas is really a math whiz, right? I mean, he gets the numbers, the odds. I mean, he's like a math.
He's a savant.
He is
a math savant. The good thing he does it for a living. He has a lot to do with math in his job.
Is there really?
Yeah, well, it would, you know, roofing and stuff and but materials and
calculating
whatnot.
Numbers and all, really? All that
sure,
stuff.
Selling with okay. the price
I don't
and
know.
Everything. Yeah, a lot know. Of. I've been in a truck with him, and yeah, he.
Oh, there's numbers
a
around.
Lot of numbers being thrown around when you're with wow. him and he's on the business call. But so we went to the horse track. Now it was Preakness weekend. However, we don't go. So the day before the Preakness, they have a day of races. Or do you, Laura, you thought it was just like one race. You thought we were there. Did you win the race that we were there for just one race?
Dave, but I don't know. I know next to nothing about
horse racing. What they don't understand.
I've seen the Kentucky Derby and that's it.
Right. So there's not just that one race that's run
okay.
all day. There are a number of races, like 13, 14, 15, upwards of 20 races.
Okay.
And these races take place every, you know, 20 to 25 minutes. So we go the day before Preakness.
Like a track meet.
And it is called Black Eyed Susan Day.
Mm-hmm. State flower of Maryland.
Yes, Andrew, did you know that I was going to... Did you know that that was the state flower of Maryland?
Sorry.
Did you? I think
I'm
you,
sure
you,
he
you,
knows. If you spend any time in Maryland, you're going to learn that.
You would know that.
So do you know what the state dessert is in Maryland?
No.
Let's see here. It would have to be something... I'm guessing... Well, I can't... something that goes well with crabs.
It's multi-layered cake.
And like an Oreo cookie. It's got to be something like not
I don't know.
Highfalutin, something a little low class, maybe.
It's a Smith Island cake.
What's that?
It's a very classy dessert.
That sounds delicious. Oh. I don't know
yeah,
why.
Andrew's shaking his head in disgust that we don't know that. I've never heard of the Smith
Island
cake.
I've never had it either.
You're going to try and out-trivia me okay. when it comes to Maryland? Please.
Good right. point. That's a Please. Really good point.
Good point. Well, do you know this then? How about this? The what does one wear when what I didn't know this either until my first time going to Black Eyed Susan Day.
Wait, hang on a second.
What does one wear?
Wait a second.
Oh, okay. Breaking news.
I got
news.
The original chocolate Whenever Smith it, Island cake.
Yeah, breaking news. We go to goodness. The news corner.
Made
Laura
from
Medicus.
Scratch. This is my kind of cake. Made from scratch. Layers of moist yellow cake and homemade fudge frosting, and that's all it is. Simple.
Those are yellow
cakes.
And how many layers is it? I know it's like a lot of layers.
27 layers.
Oh,
here.
Wow.
Look at
Very
those layers.
Thin layers.
Very thin layers. It's the homemade fudge with the homemade yellow cake. That
pretty,
is a winning
good.
Combination right there.
Good. Well, I'll tell you what also is winning combinations are horses in the right order if you pick them.
Ah.
And we did not have any of the winning combinations. But the Andrew, the wardrobe for Black Eyed Susan Day. Any idea what one wears when you go to Black Eyed Susan Day?
I have no
not if you're me or Dave Thomas or Tom Harmon. We wear shorts and t-shirts.
So I know a lot of horse races, you wear like these big ridiculous hats.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the women dress up in their.
Were the women dressed up for this, Dave?
The women get dressed up.
You only sent me photos of men.
Well, listen. You think for one second I'm going around
oh, that's a good
snapping
point.
Pictures
oh,
in
really
private
point.
And secrecy
no.
of women?
Okay,
no,
okay.
That is correct.
That's a really
like, good. No, good God, no. I didn't want to get arrested.
Sorry.
I did take lots of pictures of
men. I saw
of
pictures
men.
Of men, though.
Because what they wear is they wear shorts, dress shoes, black socks, and a tie and a sport coat. But with shorts, it looks absolutely ridiculous.
It's
Laura,
a mullet.
You had,
it's a mullet outfit.
You had the greatest, what did you say when I sent you some of these pictures, these sneaky pictures of these men with
well,
their...
They look like young lads wearing short pants. Like you might at a wedding, you'll see the little boys running around with
right.
their sport coat on and they always have shorts on.
Yes. As you said, they couldn't handle their big boy pants.
Yeah, they
so
lost.
Wearing shorts.
They did. One old man looked like he had white boxers on.
It did. They were athletic shorts.
Is that what that
but
was?
But they did look like white. Maybe I can.
With black. So the black socks was a thing. It wasn't just the old man that did it.
Everybody had on.
Weird.
Short
ahead,
pants
Andrew.
With black socks.
Stay classy, Maryland.
Always.
Yeah, Andrew. I'll show you a picture of the man. This was as we were approaching the. There's the old man. And maybe I can blur out his face and put a picture of him.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
I'll
idea.
Blur out his
he
face
looks
and
like,
put a picture of him.
So he looks like the Six Flags guy.
Oh, he does look like the Six Flags guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put a picture of him up on the website, www.theinsideflap.com.
Yeah, good idea. Just put a little black thing over his face.
Now, we don't go to Preakness is basically because that day is known for really, they call it the Freakness. The Freakness
really?
The Preakness. Yes.
I didn't know that.
If you get on YouTube.
Have you guys ever been to Preakness before?
No,
I haven't. No desire.
It's noted for the debauchery that goes on.
Really?
Hundreds of thousands of people. And they had the chain smokers. They had all kinds of.
How is that different than the Derby then?
Bands there.
Well, I think the Derby is it's more refined.
Okay.
Right?
They don't have the whole infield full of hundreds of thousands of people.
It's a big drink fest.
So it is a huge drink fest. If you want to get on YouTube and be either entertained or horrified, depending on your point of view, I want you to look up porta potty racing. So there's a video from 2008 where a guy, and what they do, and this started at the Preakness, they, you know how at these events they have long rows of porta potties. So you get guys on top of these porta potties and they run as fast as they can from one to the other.
That's funny.
While they're ducking cans of beer being chucked. So the people chuck, and this guy, you can see literally hundreds of cans of beer are being chucked at him as he tries to get from one end of the
I'm seeing it. It's called Freakness at the Preakness.
Yes, Freakness
and it's
at
called
the Preakness.
The Running of the Urinals.
The Running of the Urinals.
Yeah. And in 2016, they tried to stagger the urinals. I couldn't do it.
And
that's funny.
And you know what?
I don't think it
only gets worse from there.
Yeah, one can only imagine. But that is why we don't go to, we go the day before Preakness and throw a few money.
This looks
throw
awful.
A few coins down. Oh, it looks, there are horror stories of things that have happened.
Oh, I had no idea.
And they've talked about like pulling the Preakness out of Baltimore.
That's right. Yeah. They got so bad a couple times that they say, hey, no. If you're going to act like that, you can't have your horse race. So there's that. But, you know, it's the one time, it's at Pimlico Racetrack, and it's really the one weekend of the year where they have, and there used to be all kinds of races, but with casinos popping up everywhere and sports apps where you can gamble, going to the track is not what it used to be. And so now, when they have these weekends, they have to hire, and what we found out is they hire everyone from the neighborhood to help out, you know, with parking, with concessions, with all that stuff. So you got a lot of people working there who have no idea what they're doing.
I see.
So we pulled into the parking lot. And the first clue that we had that these were people who didn't know what they were doing is the woman, as we rolled down our window and she went to take our money for the parking spot. And she had, Tony was driving, I handed my credit card. I was going to pay for the parking. She grabs the credit card. She's got one of those devices that attach to the cell phone. You can put the card in. Well, she's trying to swipe it. She's trying to push it, to poke it. She has no idea what she's doing. And within 5 seconds, she's yelling for her, I don't know if it's her boss or what, but she goes, and this was great because it was our running gag for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And that was this, as she said, Jessica! Jessica! Like it started off like kind of quiet, Jessica. Yeah, and she, you know, she's
a smoker, ma'am.
She's a smoker. She's got maybe 4 or 5 teeth in her mouth at this point.
It's Baltimore.
It's Baltimore. I
mean, yeah,
and getting louder and louder with the Jessica. And then, that was fine. We got Jessica figured out how to put the card into the machine. The real problem was, when you get in line to place your bet, and we all got in line and we pooled our money together, so we were going to, you know, just all bet on what is called the superfecta. And when we got up to the window and said, yeah, we'd like to put so-and-so down on the superfecta, and the guy looks at me much in the same way, Laura, you're looking at me. He has
no idea what you're talking about.
Word, no. Superfecta.
I'm just looking at you with blank eyes right now.
Yeah, so hang on. I think you got to back up here. When it comes to betting on horses,
yeah,
there's this language you've got to use.
There is.
You know, I want to place $5 on the 3 and the 5, you know, to finish, blah, blah, blah.
The exacta box, exacta, the trifecta. This was the superfecta.
Okay.
This guy looked at us. He actually turned and grabbed a glossy magazine, a small magazine that might have been printed for these new employees. And he starts leafing through it as if to try to figure out what the superfecta
was. So I'm guessing he looked at you. He looked at you.
Yes.
And he looked down and he said, Jessica!
Jessica! There was no Jessica at this point to help him out.
That's funny.
So finally, Dave was like, we'll just go to another window. And we went to another.
I feel like that should be a common betting term. I'm surprised you wouldn't know what that is.
There's a certain way you got to punch it into the computer. If you want a superfecta straight, a superfecta box, it's basically you pick four horses. And they can, in any order, you're waving your hand. Well, like,
Based on how your luck was, you might have been better off placing the bet for that guy.
That's true.
And having him just place the bet at random into the system.
Yeah,
because we didn't win anything. Now, the final thing from that day at the track, though, is we did have a celebrity sighting. Andrew, perhaps you can guess the celebrity. It's a Baltimore, only people in Baltimore would guess the celebrity. If I say to you, TV...
Ed Norton?
No.
Oh, that's a good Baltimore celebrity.
That'd be a great sighting.
That'd be a good one, because he's a
Ed Norton's out there, not there, slumming it on Black Eyed Susan Day.
We're not talking movie star. No movie star.
There are no movie stars on Black Eyed Susan Day. He might have been in a private box during the Preakness. This is, if I say to you, TV, Baltimore TV weatherman, what is the first name that pops in your head?
Marty Bass.
Marty Bass. There you go. Of course. Heck yeah. This guy as I sat there and he came up. Tom Harmon stopped him because Tom had actually seen him at the Oriole game the day before. As he'd gone on a field trip and Marty was there doing some weather related stuff for
his group. Is he still a weatherman?
He's still a weatherman. As you said, he was dressed like Beetlejuice.
Yeah, he looked like Beetlejuice.
But he as Tom said, he could smell him before he saw him because he was drinking a mixed beverage. This is, you know, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, shuffling on by, and Tom stopped. Hey, Marty! And Marty stops, and Marty would just, they were just gabbies. You saw, I was sitting in front of them. I reversed my camera so I could record Marty behind him.
I saw Tom Harmon just chatting him up.
Tom was chatting him up. I hit stop. So what you did not hear was, and then we're talking about the Oriole game and the Yankee game, how the Orioles beat the Yankees. And what you could not hear was Marty Bass say to Tom, "Well, the only thing better than hearing the words Yankees lose is..." And I can't repeat this being a family podcast. I can't really repeat what Marty Bass then proceeded to say to Tom Harmon.
Was it an off-color joke?
Do you remember the controversy that Marty Bass was involved in?
I didn't know he was involved in a controversy.
Let's not go down that road, but I will say, we shouldn't go down that path, but
I'm sure they can
growing up,
Google it.
Yeah.
We watched Marty Bass as a weatherman, and... You know, he had a toupee for the longest time. And
And it was well known that he was wearing a
toupee. And it was like he's wearing a toupee. And so finally he got rid of the toupee. And I imagine he's completely bald and...
No, he had like a short hair, like a goatee. But he was, he got busted for picking up a prostitute. And she was an undercover cop. And that's what.
Oh.
So the remark he made to Tom was a sexual in nature.
Stay classy, Baltimore.
So once again, stay classy. Marty Bash and stay classy, Baltimore.
Oh, it was in late 1985.
Yeah,
a long time ago.
A long time ago. And he really came out of it no worse for wear.
Fells Point.
Patterson Park.
Supporting the local economy.
Sure.
That's right. Yeah, he had his only... Well, if you're out there and you're interested, you can read about what his defense was.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Laura, how have you been?
Well, you were gone.
Jet setting it up with Marty.
We had snow here.
That's right. I was at 97 degrees and high humidity.
And we got lucky because we didn't lose power. Did you lose power, Andrew?
It flickered, but we didn't lose it.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, we didn't lose power. But I had to go outside... You know, during the day, I was worried we would have trees. Anyway, I'm out there. I grab a broom, which I guess is what you grab. So I'm flicking the trees up and everything just to try to get the wet, heavy snow off the branches so we wouldn't lose anymore.
Always a problem. Spring comes with the leaves.
Yeah, and so I'm out by the hot tub, and we have telephone. It's not telephone wires. I think it's our power.
It's the power line. Yeah.
Our power line goes pretty low. Attaches to the house. And our lilac bushes and other stuff had fallen over top of the power line.
Oh, it was resting on the power
very
line.
Low. Mm. And so I climb up and I'm up steps on with the hot tub. There's two big steps to get into the hot tub. So I'm standing on the top step, and I'm on my tippy toes.
Poking with the broom.
Going up like this to get the lilacs, the snow knocked off, so they'll get off the thing.
Yeah, not easy to do because it's top heavy. You know, with the broom.
And I'm getting wet. It's like not graceful. It's not attractive.
Snow's falling on you.
I hear laughter coming from the kitchen.
Oh, no.
And Sylvia and her boyfriend are home. And Sylvia is filming me. And so as I'm doing it,
you're
probably
wearing slippers and a robe. I'm getting.
No, I had exercise shoes on. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At least you put shoes on.
My camo leggings that I always wear. Yeah. You know, I pretty much had this outfit on.
I think I saw you on TikTok. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I hear laughter, you know, and I give her a sour look, which she also manages to capture. Oh, and then I hear my phone that's in my pocket go ding because she'd sent it to me.
She's sending you the videos that she's taken of
you. She's taken. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with the laughter, whatever, that's fine. And, but anyway, so they go away. I believe they go away. And I'm just up there still knocking stuff off. And what I forget is that the pond is 2 feet to my right. And we don't have a railing there.
No railing. No, I took them all down.
No, I did not fall in the pond, I came so close to falling in the pond. So,
and it's like 4 feet deep right there.
It's very deep.
Right there. Well, 3 feet deep.
Man, if she'd have caught that on camera.
No.
Oh,
I know.
We would have been internet sensations.
I know. If they had, because I did think about that. I was like, boy, that would have been a good one.
Yeah.
I had my earbuds in, though.
Next time, maybe you just fall right in.
Well,
here's the thing.
So I'm up on that. And in my head, I was on level ground. I'd forgotten I was up high.
Mm-hmm.
I slipped.
Look at
I
you
fell.
Distracted.
Oh. And you know how sometimes when you fall, things go in slow-mo and you have time to like think about how you're going to land?
Yeah.
I fell so fast that I don't even know what happened. I landed like a cat on all fours on the deck. So I slipped down off the steps, landed like a kitty cat on the deck, and to my right was the pond, just lurking there, dark.
Just ominous.
Yeah. It was just one of those moments, and then I screamed as I was falling, and I hear from deep within the home laughter, and then are you okay?
There's nothing worse than hurting yourself and falling down and seeing people laugh at you.
I didn't see them. I just heard them. I don't think they'd witnessed it, so they didn't know how close I'd come to falling in the pond.
Well, let's hope not.
And otherwise, then when I came in and I was like, hey, I almost fell in the pond, they're like, huh.
It's amazing, though, how often you'll fall. Just like when I fell off the roof right over there, right near where you fell,
mm-hmm.
how someone is inevitably there to witness
it. To witness it, yeah.
So Peter has these animatronics and stuff like that, and he sets them up in the backyard.
Wait a second. Peter has animatronics?
Yeah, yeah. And so anyways, and that's his like big hobby. And so one time last year, I was cutting the grass, and we have a canal where people can like, and a trail where people can see the house. And sure enough, I'm cutting the lawn. And I'm cutting the lawn next to his animatronics, and his animatronics go off, scare the crap out of me, and I jump back from the lawnmower as these animatronics scare me, right? And then I look over, and there's three or four people standing in the canal that saw the whole thing. They're just laughing their asses off.
Well, that's a problem in your backyard. Yeah, with a running biking path right there.
People are always there.
Yeah. You have no problem.
Every summer, once a summer, we'll walk by and then call you and then wave.
Yeah. Yep. There's Andrew.
Just for the fun of it. Yeah. Yeah. No, but anyway, it was just like a cold, damp, dark weekend here. It was strange. I feel like I took 15 naps also.
And my story is, so that Thursday, it was 90-some degrees here, right?
Yeah.
90 degrees that Thursday.
Right.
The next day, basically, it started snowing Friday, right? I mean, the temperature dropped 70 degrees.
Mm-hmm. In like an hour, it felt like.
Yeah.
And very short amount of time.
In a really short amount of time. And we, you know, what we had was, we had an end-of-the-year Girl Scout party at our house.
Oh.
So we had,
I did think of you that day.
We had 40, like, kindergartner, first grade Girl Scouts over, snowing outside. We'd planned it as an outdoor party.
Sure.
We need to get a count of these kids, because it was when the time when we talked to you, and it was a little bit of a running gag in Baltimore. As you said, there were 40 kids. At one point, you said there were 30 kids. At one point, you said there were 20 kids. And Dave and Tom can all attest to this. How we need to know how many kids were there.
Were the adults there too?
Andrew loves to exaggerate, by the way.
Moms and dads were there.
How many kids?
All I can say is the kids are you know, first grade, kindergarten. They're moving so damn fast. How can you count them? I mean, honestly. I mean, and they look alike. Is that one?
So did they, were they just tearing through your basement? Is that what you guys did?
Just, well, the entire house. I mean, the kids were just bouncing. We're just bouncing all over
the place. Do you have any games set up for them? Did you, were you running any booths for them?
Different things. But we had a snow cone machine in the backyard, like under the porch.
That's what all kids want when it's 20 degrees.
I had space heaters out there.
Space heaters next to the snow cone machine. Yeah.
But you know, it's nearly June and, you know, and a huge snowstorm, but we needed the moisture, right? I mean, so, I mean, that's really best case for us is in terms of getting precipitation.
Now, how do you, so how do you keep these kids entertained though?
You know, when you've got that many kids, they pretty much entertain themselves. It's just really,
they just rove.
It's just keeping them like,
gangs
okay,
of children.
That's my office. Get out of my office. Okay. Close that desk drawer. You don't need to be like pulling stuff out of my desk drawer.
You're running around behind them, picking up.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Nobody's picking up a pair of scissors and running around with them.
Okay. That plate of food has not been touched for 10 minutes. That can go in the trash. Oh, look, there's a cup of, you know, fruit juice sitting precariously on the edge.
I don't know like how many
steps. That seems incredibly stressful.
How many steps you got in running around after those kids?
Enough. Yeah, enough.
Man. Yeah, I forgot about that because we were here. I was busy not falling in the pond, but you were running around with all those Girl Scouts. Yeah.
All right, well, let's get to it. Time for our guest, Isabel Cañas. Her new book out is called The Hacienda. It is next on my TBR list. But Laura, you read this book. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, this is just a wonderful entry into the world of Gothic horror. It's a classic haunted house book. It's set in a large, isolated estate in Mexico.
There you go.
Right after their War of Independence from Spain. I don't know very much about the Mexican independence, Mexican-Spanish War.
Right.
I think it was in 1820s, late 1820s. I don't know a lot about it, so it's a little bit of historic fiction mixed in with the haunting. And okay. So that was interesting to me because if I'm going to learn anything, I need a healthy side dose of entertainment.
Fiction. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so Beatrice is the main character, Beatrice, I think, maybe. She marries a wealthy man, Don Rodolfo, and she goes to live and manage this large estate in the Mexican countryside. And he leaves her there, and he goes back to work in Mexico City, does some work with the government. She is incredibly isolated here. There are unfriendly servants that aren't happy to see her. There's unhappy villagers and kind of snobby villagers that also aren't real happy to see her. He's got a strong, judgy sister who also kind of runs the estate and is unhappy to see her. And to make it worse, no one will go into the hacienda, the main house, at night after dark.
Ooh.
No one. Everyone disappears.
Huh.
See ya. Have a great night.
Really?
Beatriz, we'll see you in the morning. Yeah, and so she very quickly, and this very quickly happens. Some haunted house books tease you like off and on with, is it haunted?
Like
I don't know if it's
burn.
Haunted.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
This book, boom, it's a haunted house. It's really haunted. Yeah, there's something evil living inside this house. This is a scary book. It gets started very quickly, and I really appreciated that about this book. I'm not a huge fan of the slow burn tease. Haunted house books.
Yeah, get to it. That's why we read haunted house books.
Yeah.
Because that's what we want.
And I read this this weekend when you were not home, Dave.
Right.
And I was reading it after dark one night. Yeah. And we have a bedside lamp that I think, Andrew, is a lamp that you had given us a long time ago.
Ooh.
But there's something wrong with the cord of this lamp. And so it'll go off sometimes.
Oh, man.
And so I'm reading this book. And I don't know what happens, but I plunge into darkness. I'm down, then I lift up the cord and it like flickers back on, which is almost worse. And then it goes off again, and I'm trying to, you know, woman handle the cord back into the extension cord.
Right.
And it's like off, on, off, on, you know, and I'm like looking over my shoulder to see if like something evil is like creeping towards me steadily when it's off, you know what I mean? How something might get closer. Yeah, and it's scary, and then you'll hear me tell her, but I decided then, that's when I started reading a different book
during
the nighttime hours.
That's right, you had to pick up a different one, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. So haunted house stories are probably one of my top, maybe three most scary things, I think, because you're supposed to feel safe in your own home. So I think it really it preys on that for me and for most people, and this one's just terrifying. So this book also comes with a hot priest named Padre Andres.
Hot priest, mm-hmm. Hot priest.
Which you'll hear me also talk to Isabel about. Oh, yeah. It's an enjoyable, entertaining book, and I really enjoyed the Mexican setting also. It was different.
All right. Very good. And we had a great chat with Isabel, so here that is for you right now. This is Isabel Cañas. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito, quiero desnudarte a besos despacito. Firma las paredes de tu laberinto. Different vibe. We got some parks around here too. We got some parks. Yeah. A tree also grows in
Colorado. There's like a little bit of outdoors in Colorado, I hear. Just a little bit.
Yeah, overrated. Just kidding. So I loved your new book, The Hacienda.
I read this
while I was home alone.
I'm sorry.
I know. And the first half scared me so bad. And I had a light next to me and my light was a little faulty and it kept going black. It was awful. And it was so exciting though and terrifying at the same time that I actually had a strategy. Like the next day I was like, okay, I'm only going to read this book during daylight hours and I'm going to switch to something else at night, which is what I did. This is a great story. I'm a big fan of the Gothic horror, all of that. And this is, it just fed me. So what inspired
you? Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I wrote this book because I'm afraid of the dark. I always knew that. I've always known that fact. My sisters have roasted me all my life for needing to sleep with the lights on sometimes. Like when my sister's boyfriend in high school made us watch The Ring.
Oh, that's
the face
horrifying.
I'm making right now. Yes. I was horrified. I could not sleep with the light off. Yeah. I was like 13 or 14 at the time, like quote unquote, like air quotes, old enough that that shouldn't have like scared me that much, but it certainly did. I remember just watching the trailer for Paranormal Activity when it came out when I was in high school and being scared. Am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
Oh, curse
away. I was scared shitless, man. It scared me so much. So I think the great thing about writing from a place of a universal fear is that I think it connects with a lot of readers. Wow. So I'm really grateful that that was like the spirit that animated this book. And it's also a kind of fear that speaks about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I think that the fear of the dark can tap into the fear of the unknown, mm-hmm. the fear of being watched, the fear of being prey, which is very primal, something that deep in our amygdala, like evolutionarily speaking, we have really been taught to pay attention to that kind of fear. It speaks about the fear of things we cannot control. And like I wrote the latter half of this book in the most intense parts of lockdown in April 2020, wow. when we were trapped in our houses because of a force we could not see, we did not understand, and that we could not control. Right. So I think that like experience really informed this book that I came up with before the pandemic, but that has really become a relic of that like early pandemic experience.
That's
but yeah, I definitely wrote it from a place of being afraid of the dark. It was something I always knew would creep into my work at some point, but perhaps it was obvious that it would have crept in the horror genre. But even I was taken aback. There were parts of drafting this book, like the first half of it, when things are really ramping up. I think I know which parts you're thinking of. My husband was on a business trip before the pandemic. And so I slept with the lights on because I was scaring myself silly.
Oh,
you know?
Man.
I'm a massive wuss. And this is like me exposing myself as a horror writer. Because people are always like, Isabel, tell us your top 10 favorite horror books. Isabel, what's your favorite horror movie? And I'm like, guys, I'm really scared of things. Like, you don't understand.
Because I wondered, because I was so scared. And I thought, I wonder if she just was like laughing somewhere going, ho, 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 ho.
Oh, no. I was sitting right next to you, like jumping every time something creaked in the house or the light flickered. Yes. Like, I'm a very... I guess you could say I'm a superstitious person, duh. But I think that my superstitions about houses especially are informed by the fact that my family moved a lot when I was growing up. We lived, I've lost count, but we moved every 4 years basically because of my dad's job, because of the housing market, because a myriad reasons. People ask me, oh, were you a military brat? And I was like, nope, nothing. It was just, we moved a lot. And so I lived in a bunch of different houses, and I learned from a very young age I think about 5 or 6 was when we first moved into a house in the suburbs north of Chicago that was built in the 1920s or so, that was very spooky. Mm-hmm. It just had a lot of, sorry, I have an eyelash in my eye. It was very spooky and it had a lot of creepy vibes. And I became intimately acquainted with these vibes when I was put in timeout at the bottom of the stairs whenever I was 9, was bottom of the basement stairs, which was, you know.
No wonder you have a fear of the dark. Goodness gracious.
Yeah. So I, you know, there was, it was like a slightly unfinished basement. There were like exposed pipes and like the dark furnace room. It was like, you know, cobwebs and dust motes and strange shadows and very like dark, dirty windows. It was, you know, of course a little horror writer was born at the bottom of the basement stairs.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's right. They always do say, like Stephen King says, he's scared of the dark as well. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, at that time period, were you reading books to comfort yourself or were you reading, did you try to read like things that were scary just to like go into it a little bit?
I think that's not what I gravitated first towards. I'm first and foremost, I believe, somebody who was very much brought up by the fantasy genre. Mm. I was homeschooled for a lot of my time when I was a kid. And so my mom just kind of let us read whatever. Yeah. My sister has called it affectionately being allowed to run barefoot through books. And so I read voraciously. Yeah. It's beautiful. I always credit her. Like, thank you, Aurora, for giving me the best way of describing this. But I was very drawn to fantasy first. I think I loved Lord of the Rings when I was a kid. I loved Tamara Pierce books. I was very deeply into all of her series. But I think I started to get into fantasy that had darker themes and tone was when I was 13 and I read Tithe by Holly Black. It was in the school library of my extremely conservative Catholic high school. I don't know who snuck it in there, but I snuck it home. And I tore through it. And it really showed me, like, I don't know what it was, but it really resonated with me on a level that it showed me that I could write more than fan fiction. You know, I'd written a lot of fan fiction as a kid. I was really into Lord of the Rings fan fiction. I wrote my little Harry Potter derivative stuff that will never see the light of day. But I don't know what it was about that book. But I remember I encountered Holly Black in person at Worldcon in 2019. I think I was on a panel with her and I was just like starstruck. I was like, wow, it's because of you that I'm a writer. And so ever since then, I think I've been drawn to darker themes in my fantasy. And eventually, I think it was perhaps inevitable that I would finally cross the bridge over into horror. But I don't think there's like a whole lot different from fantasy and horror when you're approaching it as a writer. Yeah. And as a reader, we seek different things. She's written a lot of fantasy. The Cruel Prince series is Jeff Kipps.
I'm reading
so good.
Her books now, actually.
The Book of Night?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah. I just picked it up too. It came out on the same day as my book.
Hey, look at that.
Yay. Cool. Book release buddies. When I found that out,
that's cool.
My heart just grew to twice its size because I was like, it's because of Tide that I became a writer and both of our adult debuts are coming out on the same day.
Wow.
Did that book ever find its way back to the library or did you?
It did. Okay. I'm a fearful child. I fear authority. So I returned that book. But I did do so secretly because I think I have one parent. My dad is very religiously like conservative. My mom less so. But I think even she would have been a little, you know, I was very young.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
That's funny. That's really funny.
So Isabel, this book, The Hacienda, this is a gothic horror novel in the tradition of Rebecca and Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. And there's a long tradition of this type of book. And the heroines are pretty much always white women. As a Mexican-American woman yourself, what was it like? Was it important for you to kind of put your own stamp on this brand of fiction?
I think it's really important for me to put my stamp on all kinds of fiction, especially genre fiction, because I think, you know, a lot of people will find a Spanish surname on a shelf and assume that it's magical realism. And sure. I think that I was very afraid of being typecast when I was a younger writer. I didn't want to be like another Latin American writer who gets shoved into boxes.
Right.
I always wanted to write genre fiction and I knew that. And I was a little scared too. I I wasn't sure how my journey was going to unfold because I faced a lot of rejection in the early periods of my writing career. My first two manuscripts, which were young adult fantasy, mm-hmm. failed on submission. And I got some feedback that was like,
oh,
a little, I don't want to say loaded, but just like didn't make me feel super lovely.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
About how those editors were receiving and reading my books. So I had a lot of time to really think about what it was like to be a Latina in publishing. And the fact is that there are too few voices and we are not allowed to always, the stories we want to tell are not always super supportive. And I think the writer who's really changed a lot of that lately is Silvia Moreno Garcia.
Yeah.
Mexican Gothic blew open doors. I mean, her whole career has been really fantastic for like really opening doors for writers, Latinx writers who write in genre fiction, whether that's sci-fi or fantasy or horror, to really elbow their way in. But Mexican Gothic like blew things out of the water. And I think I was really afraid when it came out though, because I thought, what if publishing is going to tokenize her? What if my book, which I finished writing about 2 months before Mexican Gothic came out, what if publishers say, oh, we already have one of those. We don't want another one. Yeah. And our books are quite different. Like they're informed by similar Gothic traditions, but her book has more of a sci-fi spin at the end and mine is firmly rooted in the supernatural.
Yeah.
Sorry, Laura, for scaring you so much. No, but it was tough. It was something that was really important to me because when I was growing up, I hunted for books that were the kind of books I liked to read that had heroines who were like me, who had families like mine, who kind of, because representation is more than just having dark hair. Or eye color or skin color. It's about the way that a person moves through the world, their family relationships, the way that they have their experiences with power and political structures and with gender. And there are all sorts of there's so many intersections that I just felt like, you know, I clung to brunettes on the page because I was like, oh my God, Tamara Pierce wrote a brunette. She's mine now because that was all I had, you know, which is sad. And, you know, I read super sad. And so I've always known it was really important to me to write Latina heroines in my books, whether they are in fantasy novels and it's more, I come at ethnicity and race from kind of a different angle, or it's historical fiction and where things can be more historically explicit and talk about power structures and race and the tensions that arise from being of mixed heritage, in a very historically particular way, you know?
Yeah, very much. I felt that through the book. And in this book, you've just got some great elements. You have this beautiful, strong, dark-skinned woman. You know, she takes her hat off and accidentally tans. Oh, no. What's it about to do? And she's not afraid to get her hands dirty. She's digging in that garden on, like, day two, which was wild. And it's the haunting of this house is insane, Dave. Because Dave has not had the chance to read it. He is going to read this next.
Yes.
It is intense. It's so scary. And then you also add a hot priest, which thank you. Thank you so much. When did you?
I'm doing
gotta
the
have
Lord's
a hot
work,
priest.
You know?
I mean, checking off all those boxes. Hot priest.
I was like, Padre Andres, what do we have here? This is nice. When did you figure out you needed the hot priest element?
This is a fantastic question. Actually, people have often asked me about Padre Andres because I think he's a popular character.
He
resonates with people. He's a looker. He's got a really interesting backstory and he embodies a lot of tension in terms of his background and his role in his community. But he was not supposed to play a large role in this book at all. He really took me by surprise. When I approached this book, I knew I was playing with very familiar Gothic archetypes. You know, the young woman, the ingenue, who's coming into the big house, the husband who has some dark secrets, people she can't trust in the form of people who live on the property or who work there, and family members like her sister-in-law Juana in this book. And because I was raised in a very Catholic household, and because it made sense for a 19th century Catholic Mexican character who encountered a supernatural danger, like what would they do? They would turn to the church. That is a logical thing. So I also knew that I wanted Beatriz to have an experience with the church that was, I think, realistic, both to the time and to the power structures of the Catholic Church, whereby women are not always believed.
Yeah,
women's voices are not always valued. And I come from a specific Catholic experience, an Opus Dei Catholic experience, where I really struggled with, and many women I know in my family and my friends struggled with being heard or believed or being expected to fulfill very submissive social roles. And I wrote Padre Andres out of like a wish fulfillment, like a desire to have a priest who was a good community leader, who was compassionate, who listened to women. And so I knew I wanted a priest on whom Beatriz could rely and whom she could trust. And then he came to Hacienda San Isidro, and I plot my novels like,
oh, do you?
Oh, I am extremely meticulous with plotting my novels.
Okay.
I'm very, very careful. I do everything in advance. This book is an exception in many ways. One of which, an exception to my process, that is, one of which is the fact that I started writing it very quickly after having gotten the idea. Usually I let ideas gestate for 1 to 2 years. They just kind of sit on the back burner and marinate. Ideas start to really gel for a while. This one is an exception in that I started writing it very quickly after I got the idea. And also because Padre Andres absolutely shattered my idea for the book, because he arrived at Hacienda San Isidro to suss it out and to help Beatriz and really figure out what was going on with the haunting. And I remember writing one scene where he walks into the parlor. I'm a very visual writer, so I watch it in my mind's eye as my hands are flying across the keyboard. He walked into the parlor. He pulled a piece of charcoal from his pocket, crouched on the ground, and began to write on the ground.
Oh.
And I heard a voice in my, as if someone were whispering in my ear, I heard a voice saying, "He is a witch."
Wow.
And I lifted my hands off the keyboard. Because I did not plan that. And I knew, I know, I get chills talking about it, because it's one of those moments that, you know, as writers, we chase those moments. Yeah. We create. Yeah. My whole process, and it's extremely detailed and thorough, and I have like a whole practice. Like, I'm very structured about the way I approach my writing to create the conditions for this kind of genius to strike, like Greek genius. Like, I felt like somebody was moving my hands. I heard this voice saying, "He's a witch." And I knew from then the book was completely changed. I had to re-outline the whole damn thing.
Oh.
Yeah, and then he became who he is on the page, you know?
Wow.
Not only was he a mestizo, somebody whose like very being was in conflict in a role, because it was very rare in this period. I learned from my research that men of mixed heritage would have good positions within the church, would be allowed to become priests.
Oh.
And so not only is he in conflict with the power structures of the church because of who he is racially, and who his father is of white Spanish descent and his mother is of indigenous descent, but also because he's hiding in plain sight.
Yeah.
You know, he goes to seminary because to hide from the Inquisition, to hide in plain sight. And he says another line that I don't know who wrote it. Was it me? I don't know. But Beatriz says, "I just find it surprising, you know, that a priest would be a witch." And he says, "Is there any vocation more natural for a man who hears devils?"
I know, that's so good.
When that line came to me, like in the shower or something, I was like, that's it. That's the book. That's the heart of the book.
I know. I also, I got to ask you too, because I had to look it up. I didn't know what copal was.
Copal,
Paul, would you explain that to listeners?
Yeah. So it's a kind of like resin where if you burn it, it's incense. Smoke rises. It is, I guess you could say, similar to Palo Santo. Certain people use it in cleansing rituals. It's very important to certain indigenous spiritual practices. It has a multivalent role in the Americas, not just in Mexico, I think also in Central America from before the time of Spanish colonization and to the present.
Is it hard to get today? Or is it?
No, I mean, if you go online, you'll find all sorts of like stuff. But like, if you want to get like ethically sourced good stuff, there are places. If you're in Mexico, it's much easier to find.
Gotcha.
I'm not.
Have you burned it before?
I have not. It's tricky to get your hands on. It's not something that I like tracked down during the pandemic.
Yeah.
You also, it's also, I'm cautious about like appropriation of certain practices and beliefs being not of like, I mean, I think many mestizo Mexicans have indigenous heritage. They do. Mestizo by its own, by definition, means mixed. But my family is very assimilated and very Americanized. And so I feel for me, from my position in the world, it would be like a little appropriative to like, but I don't know. There are many, I'm reading a book right now by a woman who was a curandera or a healer called Women Who Glows in the Dark. The author's name is Dr. Elena, no, not doctor, nurse practitioner, Elena Avila, who wrote about her experience as like an Americanized Chicana woman born and raised in Texas who gets in touch with curandera and traditional practices and really leans into that side of herself and embraces it as kind of, I don't want to say like a reaction to, but as a way to decolonize her life. Oh, and so that's not impossible. I think it's important for people to like recognize that like these practices are very real to many people and not to like borrow them wholesale. Yeah. Kind of the same way that sometimes I like cringe when I see like calaveras on sale in Target on day, like before the Day of the Dead. I'm like, but do you guys understand what the Day of the Dead means to us? Like,
No, exactly.
So it's an interesting balance to strike, especially as a writer, writing in this historical period even, and dealing with the characters that I created. I wanted to be very faithful, authentic, and as, what's the word I'm looking for? Faithful and authentic, as I could be.
Truthful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's also the same, cause kind of the same way where I won't eat Lucky Charms. I'm just not Irish enough, you know, to get away with that. But now I saw on Instagram, Isabel, that your novel launched the same day you defended your PhD. Is that
it was the day? It was within 24 hours. Oh, I defended my PhD dissertation on May 2nd at 10 a.m. and I became a doctor by noon.
Wow!
And then my book came out the next morning.
What is your and what was your dissertation on?
My PhD is in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. I specialize in Ottoman and Turkish studies.
Wow.
And so to narrow that down even further.
Not that.
No, it's a little out of the left field. People often ask me like, what? You know, why?
Run that by me.
When I was in Turkey, they'd be like, you're Mexican? Why are you here? It's because I love learning languages. I really love learning languages.
Awesome.
And I'm very passionate about, I think studying the history of empire in the Middle East, whether that's the Ottoman Empire or British or French, it has always been something that really fascinates me. So I ended up specializing in 14th century Turkish popular literature, which if that means anything to any of your listeners, I am deeply impressed, chapeau, like for real. So basically Chaucer, but in Turkish is what I do. Yeah.
That's incredibly difficult.
It is not easy.
Were you writing your book at the same time that you were, I can't even imagine.
I was. I've written five, if you count one mess of a manuscript, six books over the course of my 7-year PhD.
Wow.
I found that it really kept me sane because the escapism of writing, you know, academia gets a bad rap for really destroying people's mental health. And it's a very well-earned reputation. I think it can be very destructive if you don't have an outlet for creative energy, a support system of people who are outside of it. And this is the same for publishing. I think all writers should have a support system of people who are not at all involved in publishing, who can help cast things in like a different light, to put things into perspective. And I think writing really did that for me with academia, because at the end of the day, it's not life or death stakes. Like, that's it.
Yep.
And I think it was a very healthy perspective for me to keep. Cool. So writing really saved my sanity over the last 7 years.
That's great.
I can totally see that, especially writing, if you were writing fantasy, also, because it's such an escape. I love fantasy. Mm-hmm. And
Same.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, it's always been a very powerful healing experience for me to write about things that I've lived from a different angle. Yeah. I think I don't know if I'll ever be able to write or be drawn to writing literary realist fiction because it's very difficult, and I admire the people who do. But when I write about things that deeply influence my life, like they come out in the form of Padre Andres, like somebody who is a child of two cultures who has deep questions about faith and belonging and identity, you know, that's how I can write about the things that I've questioned in myself, yeah. You know, and it's easier that way. But I think it also, writing this book taught me to be more vulnerable with myself in a way that I've never been with a book before. And wow. So I think it's a very special book for me, and I'm very lucky and grateful that it gets to be my debut. That's, you know, great.
That's awesome. Yeah. All right, well, Isabel, it's time now for our segment we call Quick Six. These are six quick questions in which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is, get ready, get set, what is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Stranger Things. I'm in the middle of season 3, near the end of season 3.
You're just in time for season 4. Look at you ramping up for season 4.
Exactly. That's smart. I had nightmares last night because I'm a weenie.
That's funny. Oh man, I'm so jealous. I would have loved to have.
Yeah, because now it'll be fresh in your mind. Now we're gonna have to go rewatch season 3 just to remember what the hell's going on.
And it's not an easy experience.
It's tough. It's a good. It's a good
messy.
Show.
It's
good
messy.
Show.
Good yeah. Show. So Stranger Things.
All right, good one.
What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
I would love to visit the world in Lainey Taylor's book, Strange the Dreamer.
Mm. That sounds good.
It's about, it's a difficult book to pitch. It's the kind of fantasy book that breaks every single rule along the way and is a masterpiece of voice and world building. Wow. But basically it's about whether it's a high fantasy, very secondary world. It's about an orphan who grows up as a librarian and how he's obsessed with finding the source of a myth about a lost city of which nobody remembers the name, and cool. He gets to go there, and he finds, and the whole story is about whether or not reconciliation and forgiveness are possible after a really destructive war. Mm. It's a great book.
Sounds good. Yeah. How about this? Give us one of your top 5 favorite movies of all time.
I really love The Princess Bride.
Oh yeah.
Inconceivable.
I love it. That's great. Love it. Yeah. I love it. I love it. I love it. It has everything. It has princesses. It has irreverence. It has pirates. It has, you know, it mocks the church. It does. And I'm in 100%.
Kids still love it. I'm a high school theater teacher, and I just not half an hour ago just watched two kids act out a scene from The Princess Bride. They love it.
Oh, I love it. I love it, Dave. I love it.
How about a top 5 favorite book?
I would say, well, Strange the Dreamer, of course, but for variety, I would say The House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende. Oh, it was one of those books when I read it when I was 21 and in a place in my life where I was very, very lonely, very lonely. And I felt like it was coming home.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book. I love her. Yeah.
Isabel, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I don't do a lot of karaoke, but if I were forced to, we are making you do one.
Yes.
I really love. I could belt out Despacito. My husband and I had a very informal wedding, and that ended up being our first dance song.
Hell yeah, you did. That sounds amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading House of Hunger by Alexis Henderson. It is a gothic fantasy. She's incredible. I love what she does with atmosphere. Like, I study it. Her prose is beautiful. Mm. It comes out in September, and it's got blood drinking. It's got like this like hedonistic court and this young woman who enters it and finds herself in a position where she starts to fall for this countess. I'm in the middle of it, who's very hedonistic and dangerous. And there is a mystery afoot, so we have to solve some things. But the atmosphere itself is just dripping with gothic deliciousness.
She's a great writer.
She's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, well, Isabel, thank you so much for joining us. Laura hasn't stopped talking about The Hacienda since she finished it. Can't wait to read it.
Beautiful and, cover, too.
Yes. And thanks so much for taking some time to chat with us.
My pleasure. I've got to jump, but thank you so much for having me. This was a delight.
Bye.
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 The Inside Flap.
All right, there you go. Check out her book. That's Isabel Cañas. The book is The Hacienda. Andrew.
Oh, I was going to say about the walk-up music. Aren't we doing the walk-up music this week?
Oh yeah.
Well, we haven't played.
We haven't gotten there yet. Okay,
he's really excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, remember we played the jingle.
Okay.
And then
okay.
Okay. Hmm. All right. Well, I got a lot of buttons to hit over here.
He's the only one that remembers because I, well, out of Andrew and I, you probably remember Dave, but yeah, I never remember.
You're the one who doesn't remember.
That's true.
So when you say he's the only one who remembers.
You could also say I'm the only one who doesn't.
That would be an incorrect assessment. All right, let's open it up. The library is officially open. Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Where we are.
All right, Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I forgot again. So, I have a book called Suburban Dicks by Fabian. Let me go for this last name.
Okay, go for it.
Nasiaza.
Swing for the fences.
Nasiaza. Fabian Nasiaza.
Yes.
This guy is the co-creator of Deadpool, and he's written a ton of Deadpool comics.
Yeah, and you got your hot little hands on this one right before I did. We both had this one on hold. You got it first.
I did. So I got it first.
To hear about
In my
this.
Defense, when I read the description of this book,
yeah,
I somehow missed that he was the co-creator of Deadpool. And then, because I'm not a comic person or a superhero, I you know, just not that, it's not my cup of tea,
right?
And I also missed, I thought this was a cozy. It's not quite cozy. You could maybe argue
any
that
book
it is
written by the co-creator Deadpool is not going to be
it's not hardcore, you know, murder, but it's also not necessarily cozy,
right,
either.
Yeah.
So if you ever wondered, hey, what if I could read an amateur detective book as witty as Deadpool?
Oh,
wonder no more.
All right.
So this is set in suburban New Jersey, and it stars a heavily pregnant mom of four. Number five is on the way. Her name's Andy.
Wow.
And a young, down on his luck, Asian American reporter named Kenny Lee. And they team up to solve a murder of an Indian gas station attendant in their very small suburb. Why am I mentioning their race?
A lot of race talk going on.
So the book talks about race in a way I just found really refreshing. It was quick-witted, biting, just matter of fact and real. And I don't know that I've ever read anything quite like it. It's a continual undercurrent throughout this book is racial stereotypes. They're talked about in a funny way by a lot of the characters that have different races. Every race in this book, they are aware of their particular stereotypes, except for the white folks in here. And they're very aware of the other races' stereotypes. Huh. And they talk about them. They make jokes about them. They also talk about how hurtful they are in some cases to them and how other ones don't bother them as much. Very interesting. The characters don't feel like they fit in most of the time. They're either not their race enough, you know, or they're not, quote, American enough. So there's no real spot for them is how a lot of them feel. So there's mystery in the book, and it's really enjoyable. The actual mystery itself is very, very well done. But just like in Deadpool, when there's action, which there is great action scenes in this book, there's humor in it continually throughout.
Yeah.
And it's very funny. And so that's more the most enjoyable part was the all the racial stereotype talk that was real, and it's stuff that is very serious, especially with the stuff that's gone on recently. And, you know, it does need to be talked about. We can't pretend it's not there.
Right.
So the second book in this series comes out next month in June. So this book is a finalist for an Edgar Award for the best first novel.
It came out last
year. And it's a highly entertaining murder mystery. Completely surprised me. I thought I was getting a cozy mystery. It is not. And it just has humor and warmth. Very good.
Great. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. And that book is Suburban Dicks. And the author,
Fabian Nasiaza.
Nasiaza.
Co-creator of Deadpool.
All right. Check it out. That's recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week,
Dave Medicus.
This is why we can't have no.
I always get, I just want to sit here and listen to the song whenever
it is good.
My music comes on.
Yeah.
I got to go. Oh, man. Well, speaking of entertaining reads, I got a very entertaining read for you. It is titled Bullet Train by Kotaro Isaka. And this is translated from Japanese. And I'm very excited about recommending this book because not only Is this one fun? Is it exciting? It is entertaining. It's a satirical look at professional assassins set aboard a bullet train traveling from Tokyo to Morioka.
Wow.
But it's also going to be a major motion picture this summer.
Ooh.
Starring Brad Pitt.
My favorite. Yes,
with appearances by Sandra Bullock.
Wow.
And Lady Gaga.
Huh?
I have seen.
So are there, wait, so this is written by a Japanese person. Is it a bunch of white people on the train?
No, it's all Japanese people, but I'm assuming that several of the characters have been changed to. Because clearly Brad Pitt is not playing a Japanese guy.
No.
As I watched the trailer, and they've taken some liberties, but it is filled with, it's still set in Japan. It's on the Japanese bullet train, but. And everyone else is Japanese.
This movie looks good.
But Brad Pitt is not. Listen, the movie...
Well, I know Brad Pitt's not. Yeah.
Is looks good. The book is good.
Wow.
So I think it's always fun when you read a book and then you go watch a movie about it. So here's a perfect opportunity for you to do so.
Looks like Lady Gaga is not in this, Dave.
Oh, maybe that's some misinformation I got. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. No problem.
Brad Pitt in a bucket hat, though.
Yeah, well, see, he's playing a character.
Which I don't know how I feel about that.
He's playing a character.
It makes him look kind of dumpy, am I
who
right?
Who is a professional assassin, but he considers himself to be the unluckiest assassin in the world. And so he's always talking about what bad luck he has. And in fact, in this book, he has one job. He's hired to get on this high-speed train to steal this suitcase and then get off at the very next stop.
So the thing is, I've seen the previews.
Oh, you have?
Oh, you've seen it.
Right?
Yes.
And I haven't. And so I don't know that they're really like pushing that it takes place in Japan.
Oh.
Right? The preview that I saw is showing that...
It's just on a train.
It's showing it's on a train.
Okay.
And Brad Pitt looks like the most unlucky assassin.
Right. That's like, what he is. Yeah.
In the history. I mean, he just like has like tons of bad luck. And so...
Is it funny then?
Well,
the book is hilarious.
The trailer looks really pretty good.
Yeah.
And if you've seen Lost City, I think it's Lost City.
With Sandra Bullock?
Where Brad Pitt plays in that.
I liked him in that.
And he kind of plays like this, a similar character.
He was great in that.
But it's also very funny. He's extremely funny.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of making fun of his own stereotype.
Okay, cool.
Right. And that's what this character does. And
this
he's got
a great book.
So he's got a woman in his ear talking to him, and that woman in the movie is Sandra Bullock, but he's got a woman who's talking to him, telling him where the suitcase is. But also telling him that there are all these other
assassins on this train. Oh, I'm excited.
Unfortunately for Brad Pitt's character, who is...
I like how you're just calling it Brad Pitt's character.
Well, it's Nanao, called Ladybug. Or Ladybug, I believe.
Ladybug, because I just saw it on
Ladybug.
Film.
There's also these two other assassins. They're called Lemon and Tangerine. Now, one of these guys is obsessed with Thomas the Train, and he's always comparing all these other characters to a character from the show. There are these hilarious characters, also trained assassins, also going after the suitcase. There's also this kid on the train. They just call him the Prince, who's a kid, and he looks very, just kind of regal, and he's got these soft feminine features. Looks like they, call him the Prince. But he is so evil. He's a sociopath, truly, truly evil. And there's this other former assassin, Kimura, looking for the prince, who Kimura is trying to get some revenge because the prince perpetrated some crimes against his son. And now his son is in a hospital because of what the prince did to him. And that's just the beginning. I mean, these all their worlds end up overlapping. There's a drug lord gangster who might be behind it all. There are other assassins who may or may not be on the train. There are knives, snakes, poisons, broken necks, double crosses, everything you could ask for in a thriller, all set aboard this fast-moving train where the killer's biggest problem soon becomes where to hide the bodies of the murder victims that begin to stack up. And it's so great because the narrative switches frequently between all the different characters, and you get to see where they are. Like each chapter heading shows all the trains and the cars, but the one train that's outlined is where you're starting
with. Oh, that's cool.
So you can visualize where all the other characters are on the train while the action is happening. So good.
So I'm assuming that something like this that takes place on the bullet train.
Yes.
is fast paced.
It is. It is. Yes. It is very fast paced. And
comes out, the movie comes out July 29th.
Oh, yeah.
Late summer.
I can't wait to see this one. And then you got this guy, Kimura, who's really the heart of it. And we flash back to his story and what happened with his son. And we kind of follow along and see, was this assassin, became this drunk, and now he's trying to redeem himself through the eyes of his son.
I'm all in.
Who's like the heart of it. It's so good. One of the best
action. Did you listen to this?
No. I actually read this one. Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the best action books I've ever read. Super fast.
Really?
Andrew, as you say, intriguing characters. These characters, they're funny. They're out of the ordinary. They're hitmen and hired guns. Just the one location. They have nothing to lose, everything to gain. And what is in that suitcase? Man, great read for the summer. With the movie coming up in late July, check it out. Mm. Bullet Train by Kotaro Isaka. Really, really good. And that is recommended by
Dave Medicus.
All right, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd.
Don't stop, make it pop. DJ, blow my speakers up tonight. I'm a fight.
What do you got for us?
So my book this week is a fantasy novel. It is called The Firstborn Academy. It is a coming-of-age story.
Hmm.
And, you know, I'd say it's a little bit like Harry Potter meets, you know, almost like, let's see. I'm trying to think.
Star Wars?
No, not Star Wars. It's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to say, but it's more of a more mature, like, magical academy.
Okay.
And it has sort of a different premise. And the author is Isla Frost. And so
fantasy music.
It's the premise here is basically some youths have to make their way, and they're like teenagers, 17, 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
and they basically have to make their way to this academy. But they have no idea what's in store for them because nobody ever comes back.
Mm. Oh.
And so the premise was this takes place in a near Earth future.
This looks like urban fantasy. I just did a quick. Is it urban fantasy?
And I guess it is. I would say called urban fantasy. And what happens is, you know, it could be this day and age, right? I mean, so it's very relatable. And what happens is the walkers basically come to Earth, and they call them the walkers because they walk between worlds.
Hmm.
And you know what really makes the walkers, they're humanoid. They're compatible with humans, as you find out in the book.
Oh dear!
Yeah, that's right.
Where that goes.
Not in any great detail. Yeah, yeah.
Family show.
I've read
family
my share show. Of it. Yeah.
All right, Marty Bass, so calm down, Marty Bass.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of you know,
sure,
romance in there. So, anyways,
yeah, we got it.
But the walkers live for like walking between the worlds and looking at the beauty and everything between the worlds. But when the walkers
wink, wink, nudge, know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So. Oh, we got another Marty Bass over here.
So when the walkers come to Earth, unfortunately, something comes with them, right? And so the walkers bring magic, and so the magic that they bring, everything comes alive, right? It sparks the magic that's already here to grow.
Oh, yeah.
Things in nature grow.
Okay.
You know, creatures that were harmless before aren't harmless anymore.
Interesting.
So they unfortunately are not... you know, they are not like these nice, beautiful walkers or these creatures. Unfortunately, you know, things happen where they go. And so the planet Earth has been completely transformed.
Cool. That's a great premise.
Yeah.
The
always with these urban fantasy, they got to explain what happened.
Yeah. And you know, and I explain, they don't get too technical, but they explain it. And part of like the reading the book is you kind of know like how things are. And so what happens is humanity's hanging on by a thread.
Yep.
They're living in these walled enclaves.
So humans are outnumbered by the magical stuff?
Oh, a big time.
Oh,
and it's so dangerous that they don't even have windows into the wilds.
Wow.
Right? They live in these small, wild off cities.
This book sounds like my cup of tea.
Yeah, it really does.
I'm going to put this on hold. This sounds really good, Andrew.
And so they don't even have windows because because the wilds are so dangerous that if you have a window... Right? I mean, chances are something can come in and grab you. And so
I'm putting it on my wanna read list.
And so the walkers basically use magic and portals to bring food to the humans.
Okay.
And the only agreement they have with the humans is that, you know, your firstborn, when they turn, you know, 17, I think it is, they have to basically go to the firstborn academy. And nobody ever sees or hears.
And you have to.
And so what happens is...
And they never come back to that community?
No. And so what happens is if you don't send your firstborn, then they will come back and murder your entire family.
Huh.
Right? And, you know, and so you really have no choice.
So, that's really interesting.
And so the book starts out, and Nova is the main character, and she has a great relationship with her family. She has friends. She loves her world. And, you know, when it comes to the walkers are basically helping them survive, but the walkers are also to blame for what's happened to Earth, right? Europe, the continent of Europe, something evil has taken place there where Europe has gone completely offline.
Mm.
Like, there's no real technology anymore. Like, everybody mm-hmm. is just really, like, subsistence living, you know, and they have to, and they depend on the walkers to basically survive. And so Nova basically, with one of her good friends, ends up having to go to the Firstborn Academy. And so they go into this portal not knowing what to expect. They don't know if they're going to get eaten. I mean, they really have absolutely no idea. And they get locked in a room. And basically they're in this room and another girl shows up. And there's three girls. And the academy is made up of, you know, both, you know, boys and girls that basically show up at the academy. But they're locked in this room and, you know, there's no instructions and they're just in this room. And so they're thinking, and the room has like maybe a 20, 30 foot ceiling or something like that. And so they're thinking, well, you know, maybe it's a test. Maybe they want us to figure out how to get out of the room. Well, it turns out that is not, that is not the right answer.
Whoops.
Right? So of course, you know, I guess there's humor in the book, and some of the humor too comes down to the fact that the academy that they're in, this old house, this old castle has basically become, you know, it basically has become, what do you call it? It's alive, right? And so in that room, they actually do damage to the room.
Kind of like a Hogwarts.
Yeah, and the house is not happy about the fact that they've damaged it, you know, significantly. And so
wow.
So it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny what relates to that and like the lengths they go to try and make up to the house. Because it's making their lives, I mean, literally a living hell. And so, but also at the academy are young walkers. And so they're being forced to train with the humans and the walkers together. And the humans don't like the walkers don't like the humans. And then you basically have the different races that are that are the professors trying to teach, but nobody trusts each other. The humans don't trust walkers don't trust the humans, and they're supposedly brought together to work together, except that there is no trust. And this is no, you know, this is no laid back, you know, Gryffindor, Slytherin type of thing. I mean, they are literally in the first day, they're put to all these trials, you know, and these trials are tough enough that students do die. I mean, basically their lives are threatened every single second. And, you know, and that's with the academy. And so there's a bit of a mystery here, too, in terms of what is the academy? You know, like what happened to Earth and, you know, and what's the situation? So a lot of this stuff basically gets revealed. But, you know, it is a tough school. There is trial after trial. There is mystery. And, of course, you know, Nova, perhaps her magic does not work like everybody else's magic.
Of course.
You know?
Yep, they never do.
The way it works.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe she is the key to, you know, and because the planet Earth basically is at risk. I mean, you get the sense in this book, I mean, everybody is on like a nice edge of not surviving at all. You know, and some of the creatures in this book are terrifying, like, you know, spiders and just all kinds of things, but, you know, not like little spiders and stuff like that. Now, I say this, but on the way home from recording last week, you know, I basically get in my car, and I guess I had left the sunroof open.
Oh,
right?
No.
And so as I'm in the car,
driving
away, there's a big old spider inside my car, like jumping around, like jumping around on the dashboard. And it's nothing like driving the car knowing that there's a
large spider,
you know,
there.
There's like a nickel sized spider that could literally jump out while you're driving the damn car. And, you know, at one point I'm driving like beside a cop and I'm wondering if he's like looking at my squirrely behavior. And it's like, you know,
those guys on spider drugs.
I'm on edge because I'm expecting this, you know, nickel sized spider to come jumping to basically come jumping out. But I say that because there's all the creatures in this book, you know, and I personally am afraid of a little house cat. I'm afraid of, you know, a spider. I'm afraid of a little snake. Well, you know, if you ultra-size these things.
Yeah, if you get them big.
You know, and imagine living in an environment where everything
could kill you.
Is trying to kill you. And you out in the wilds. I mean, it's not like there's friendly creatures trying to help you. Everything is absolutely trying to kill you. You know, and that's really what they're at that academy, learning how to survive in the wilds.
This book sounds great. It's a 4.11 on Goodreads.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the book is The Firstborn Academy by Isla Frost.
All right. Very good. Check it out. That's recommended by
Andrew. Boy, both of your books sound great.
Which means, and I got a good
audiobook
of the week from you from 1983. I give you a little book you may have heard of. It's called Pet Cemetery.
Oh, you listened to it. King.
I decided, listen,
that's
I just saw
idea.
Well, I saw a interview where Stephen King called this book the one book that he wrote that crossed the line. He said it is the one of the most disturbing books in his mind that he ever wrote. And I said, you know, it has been nearly 40 years since I read all these old Stephen King classics.
Yeah, I don't even remember reading it. Go ahead, Andrew.
So I've often said, like, I've experienced personal tragedy. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, just unbelievable stuff. But I will always say that with Pet Sematary, you know, there's the opening scene where Gage, right, is basically, and I think it's a little boy. What's the little boy's name?
That's the little boy's name. That's not the opening scene. That's of the book. Maybe we don't want to confuse it with the movie or give anything away that might give anything away.
Okay.
But yeah. You're saying,
I don't, honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, because I've seen the movie and I saw it when I was a teenager, I don't know if I've read the book.
Oh, it is.
I don't know if I have. I feel like I would have remembered
I've read the book,
reading
but it's been a long
time. Right, and it's been a long time for me. So I went back and listened to it. And first of all, it's read by Michael C. Hall, who plays Dexter. And he does such a great book. It's set in New England. He does all the New England accents. Hmm. He's so good. And this is just a great audiobook to listen to. It is creepy as hell. It is extremely unsettling.
I guess I did read it.
There is, just in this book, an uneasiness.
It's an unsettling book. You're right, now that you say that.
Every minute of it, and it just gets growing more and more and more as you read it. And I thought I knew what was coming in the book, but I did not. I forgot a lot of stuff that happens, especially in the latter half of the book and the ending. Good God, the ending. It's been 40 years. I did not remember it correctly. And I was glad I didn't remember it because this is good stuff if you're a horror fan.
Now I think there's something about like the Indian burial cemetery.
Right.
Which just kind of makes it a little bit more believable somehow.
Exactly. And this is, might even be back before that was a trope.
Like Poltergeist.
The story of the Creed family, the doctor husband who gets a job at a college.
I haven't seen it, but there is a pet cemetery near Euclid Middle School, which is middle school.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So he brings his family up to this small town in rural New England. He's got his two kids. He's got a little daughter and a baby named Gage who grows there. You know, they're there for a little bit, like a toddler. And the old man who lives next door, and this is very character driven, as much of Stephen King's stuff is. It's small town characters, these folksy, whimsical characters like the old guy next door, Judd, with his New England charm and his stories of the old days, and what is behind that house that they move into, the old pet cemetery, and just beyond the pet cemetery is the land where the old Indian burial ground is, and that's if you know, you know. If you don't know, boy, you are in for a real treat.
When I was little, seeing Poltergeist with that, where they had the swimming pool, terrified me.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember the swimming pool?
No.
Yeah. They always dig for a swimming pool, and then they're like, oh, there's a skull. And then they're like, ha-ha, this is fine. Toss it aside.
Wait, I remember like when Salem's Lot came on TV as a kid, too. That was pretty scary. Yeah.
Well, and that, I just, with my gift card, that was one of the books that I bought. I'm going to go back. So after listening to Pet Sematary, I listened to Cujo. I'm listening to The Dead Zone right now.
I had no idea.
And I thought I wanted to spring it on you right now. This is the summer of Dave's
summer of Stephen King
obsession with Stephen
Vintage
King.
Vintage King.
I got Firestarter and I got Salem's Lot. today with my
Salem's Lot was really good.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited to revisit those. This is good stuff. It is disturbing. Any book that Stephen King himself calls his most disturbing work.
Yeah.
But if you're a horror fan and if you're in for this kind of stuff, give it a listen. It's good stuff. So let's take a listen to the clip. This is Michael C. Hall reading from Stephen King's Pet Cemetery.
Then they rounded a final curve, and there was the house that only he had seen up until now. He had flown out and looked at each of the seven possibles they had picked from photos once the position at the University of Maine was solidly his, and this was the one he had chosen. A big old New England colonial, but newly sided and insulated. The heating costs, while horrible enough, were not out of line in terms of consumption. Three big rooms downstairs, four more up, a long shed that might be converted to more rooms later on. All of it surrounded by a luxuriant sprawl of lawn, lushly green even in this August heat. Beyond the house was a large field for the children to play in, and beyond the field were woods that went on damn near forever. The property abutted state lands, the realtor had explained, and there would be no development in the foreseeable future.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook of the week.
Audiobook of the week. And that will do it for us this week. Episode 169 in the books. Thank you to Isabel Cañas for hopping on. You can find her book at the tattered cover on Colfax or wherever you get your your books.
That's funny. Beautiful cover. Her book, Hacienda. The cover is so pretty.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
My name is Dave Medicus, and we'll see you next time.
Adios.
Excelsior.
Sorry.
I did take lots of pictures of
men. I saw pictures of men, though.